Hello, everybody. Greetings. Welcome. It's Peter Cass here, and welcome to the Clinical Cases podcast. This is a podcast where we look at a recent clinical case and have a look at the learnings around that case. So this case is of a 36-year-old woman who presents to the emergency department with a complaint of numb feet. And she in fact said, "I can't feel the pedals in the car when I'm driving." It started about 2 days previously and it seemed to have been increasing. Or she said, I think it's going up my legs. There are no other symptoms. The patient is well otherwise. She has a medical history of diabetes and has had a recent chest infection. Her examination revealed due heart sounds, bilateral equal air entry, symmetrical sensory loss in the feet to about the levels of the ankles, and there was no other neurology to find. So she's seen on the night shift by the registrar, who diagnoses a sensory loss secondary to diabetes more than likely. The patient is then sent home with a plan to review with her endocrinologist as early as possible. The patient represents 2 days later, and she now has weakness in her lower limbs. There's no back pain. There is no bladder or bowel disturbance in this case. So what would you do next? What's your working diagnosis? How should we investigate this patient? What's the role that we have in the emergency department? Obviously, because we're talking about the case right here and right now, the diagnosis wasn't diabetes. So this is a case of Guillain-Barré syndrome, and it is a disease that has a low prevalence, high stakes. There's about 100,000 cases worldwide per year. It does have a significant morbidity in that about 20% of patients will never walk unaided after about a year. The mortality is about 5%. It's important that we keep it in mind when patients present with neurology because it is such a low prevalence disease. So let's have a look at the classic presentation is usually symmetric, ascending, flaccid paralysis. So it's usually preceded by bilateral sensory changes such as paresthesias. It will start in the lower extremities and usually ascends. There are decreased or absent reflexes. And in some variants, reflexes are retained or even increased. Now, the patients may also present with respiratory distress due to diaphragmatic weakness. And in some of the variants, they can present with hemodynamic compromise due to dysautonomia. Now, Guillain-Barré syndrome is an immune-mediated peripheral nerve disease. It's theorized that an infection of some cause results in antigens being created that resemble the host cells. And so the body's immune system then generates antibodies in order to fight these. And what happens is that we have these variations of Guillain-Barré presentation, and they're usually associated with the targets that these antibodies hit. So the most common is a demyelinating polyneuropathy of the Schwann cells, and this presents with ascending weakness and decreased reflexes. Other variants, however, can present with ophthalmoplegia and ataxia and areflexia without any weakness. This is the Miller-Fisher syndrome. But we can also have cranial nerve abnormalities such as ptosis, difficulty swallowing. And these patients may have upper extremity weakness, and there'll be a preservation of sensation and power in the lower limbs. This is a cervicobrachial pharyngeal variant. Now, there are others that'll have sensory loss but no weakness. And then there's the ones that can cause a significant confusion, I think, in the emergency department, the dysautonomic variant, where they get orthostatic hypotension, they'll get an ileus, urinary retention, areflexia, ataxia, and they'll have no motor weakness whatsoever. When the patients present, they can present in the acute phase, which is the first couple of weeks, or they can present in a progressive phase, which is sort of 2 to 4 weeks, and then there's a plateau phase, which occurs after 4 weeks and can last for several months. So they can present in many ways, and they can be confusing. That's why we have to think of this diagnosis. The risk factors for developing Guillain-Barré are infectious causes, vaccinations, medications, and medical conditions. So infectious causes, viral causes, cytomegalovirus, SARS-CoV-2, measles, dengue, influenza, bacterial, such as Campylobacter, mycoplasma pneumonia. And this patient, remember, had a chest infection. Vaccinations such as influenza, mumps, measles, rubella, and COVID-19, and multiple medications, but mostly the MABs, the ipilimumab and all the other MABs, and medical conditions such as conditions that cause significant trauma, so surgery, myocardial infarction, and even pregnancy can cause it in these patients. What confuses us is that we don't have significant diagnostic criteria. There's the NINS, or National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke criteria, and the Brighton criteria. Now, it appears that the Brighton criteria have a higher sensitivity. However, both of these should just be used as screening criteria, and they may not be helpful in the emergency department. So the Brighton criteria includes bilateral flaccid weakness of the limbs, hyperreflexia or areflexia. They also look at the lumbar puncture results, so a CSF cell count of less than 50, but a protein concentration of greater than 60. And we've all been taught that in a lumbar puncture, they have a high protein count. Now, the investigations that we need to perform for all these patients to come to the ED are, first, potassium and phosphate. Why? We want to make sure this is not some kind of hypokalemic periodic paralysis. The CSF may help us, as we said, if they have an overall low cell count but a high protein count, and this is called cytoalbuminologic dissociation. But we shouldn't rely, we can't rely on the CSF to make the diagnosis, because if it's performed in the first one day after symptom onset, 50% of the CSF will be normal. It won't show this dissociation. This increases to about 88% at 3 weeks post-symptom onset. So it may not help us. Neuroimaging is important, but it doesn't diagnose Guillain-Barré. What it does is it helps us diagnose other causes of weakness and paresthesia. So MRI is the modality of choice in these particular patients. So what's our role in the emergency department? So our role is primarily stabilisation, making the diagnosis, and then we have to specifically pay attention to the airway, and maybe there may have to be respiratory intervention in these patients. And the reason for that is because as the paralysis ascends, it affects the abdominal muscles, the diaphragm and the intercostals, which may then affect ventilation, resulting in hypoxia and hypercarbia. Generally, respiratory compromise or fatigue will require intubation in these patients. Non-invasive ventilation can be used in the short term, but it's a temporary fix and it increases the risk of aspiration. So they have to be intubated, and certainly they have to be intubated for transport. So what are the findings that may suggest that we need to intubate these patients? Difficulty coughing, not a good cough and unable to clear secretions. They can have dyspnea or difficulty breathing. They a forced vital capacity of less than 20 mil per kilo or a drop of 30% over a period of time and a single breath count of less than 20. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 30, 40, 50, 6, 7, 8, 9, 20, 1, 2. So they stop at 20. Hypoxia, hypercarbia, and they, in the autonomic variant, have vital sign abnormalities such as tachypnea and tachycardia. When we do intubate these patients, we have to be careful that we avoid succinylcholine or succinylmethionine because it can result in hyperkalemia. Rocuronium is the paralysis drug of choice. Normal dosing, though, in these patients may result in prolonged paralysis. However, it's a trade-off between getting a rapid paralysis and having it prolonged. And I suppose if we need to reverse it, sugar medics can be used to reverse it. The dysautonomia that occurs with these patients can result in arrhythmias. Now, sinus tachycardia is the most common. However, We can get ventricular arrhythmias. We can get bradycardias. We can get asystole. And sometimes we need to use adrenaline for bradycardia and hypotension, and these patients may need to be paced. When we're using medications, we have to be careful because sometimes the effects are transient. So when the patients get abnormal blood pressures due to the autonomic effects, they can go from severe hypertension, where we can use drugs such as labetalol or esomelol, and the severe hypertension can cause posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome in these patients that present with visual disturbances, altered mental state, and seizures. It is of great concern when they present with hypotension, because one of the problems that we have is the shock algorithm that we use really favours sepsis, and we've got to be a little bit careful in these patients. So our role is a respiratory one and managing arrhythmias or blood pressure issues that can occur. The definitive treatment of Guillain-Barré syndrome is to use intravenous immunoglobulin or plasma exchange. In the emergency department, we must think of Guillain-Barré syndrome in any patient that presents with a sensory abnormality, plus or minus motor weakness and reflex abnormality, because it's a disease that is associated with significant morbidity and mortality. All right, I hope you've enjoyed this brief review of Guillain-Barré syndrome. I'll see you next time.